And today's Mishnah is from the 8th and 9th Mishnah, from the 4th parak of Masechta Ketubot. The Mishnah begins, Hamotzei et ishto mishum eilunim. If someone divorced their wife because she was an eilunim, means she was born in a way she wasn't able to have children, Rabbi Yehuda says, lo yachzir, he cannot remarry her. Now the concern for this is similar to what we said yesterday, and that is she might remarry, actually have children from that marriage. The first husband will say, one second, I divorced her based on the assumption she was an eilunim, which means the get's not really a get, because she can have children. And therefore, she's still married to me, and those children she had from the other marriage are considered mamzerim. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says that they make a gzera, they can never remarry her, such that they make the husband fully aware that the divorce is absolutely final, and never be able to get married again, irrespective of what develops. And that way, there would be no concern, even if she does remarry and then unfortunately does have children. What's interesting here is Rabbi Yehuda is concerned for this concept of Shema Yomar, maybe this situation will develop, and he'll say, had I known, I would have never divorced her. Which is different to the previous Mishnah, because if you remember, in the previous Mishnah, he brought a different reason. He was one of the few opinions that wasn't concerned of Shema Tomar, and when it came to divorce based on Nadarim or because of Nishum Shemra, it was because of other reasons, as almost like a deterrent, or because of Benot Yisrael being put up by Arut and Nadarim. So what's the difference? And the difference is because Kati goes into more detail here. The difference is, in the previous Mishnah, if you remember, when it came to Nadarim, he was held like Rebbe Elazar, that the husband may have preferred to divorce in the case of Nadarim rather than bringing her to Beit Din and making this whole public show to try and mevata the Nadarim. So Rebbe Yehuda there is less concerned of the Shem or Tomar, because it's less of a claim that he would say that, oh, had I known, because he wouldn't necessarily brought her to Beit Din anyway. However, this case is different. When it came to the case of an Eilonit, Rabbi Yehuda is indeed concerned that the husband would say Shema Tamar. However, Chachamim say in this case, absolutely Yachzir, they can get remarried. Why? Because the Chachamim in this case is the opinion of Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that says, Kol t'nai she'enu k'tnai b'nei gad b'nei ruven enu t'nai. If you recall back from Chumash, the b'nei gad and b'nei ruven, they were the ones that took their chalik of the nachala on the Transjordan. And a t'nai, a condition, was made at the time, that if you go and join your brothers and help with kibush ha'aretz and conquering the land, then fine, you can get your share. But if you don't, then no, you'll have to have your share across with everybody else in the main area of Eretz Israel. So what's important there is that's what's called a t'nai kaful, a two-way condition that say the consequences of both the positive and the negative action. So therefore, in this case, since a husband didn't apply a t'nai kaful, a two-way condition, when you divorced her, that means if you're an eilonit, then you're divorced. And if you're not an eilonit, then you're not divorced. Since he didn't articulate in that manner, then it's considered a fully-fledged divorce. Even if she gets married and has children, the husband won't be able to say, the whole thing was under condition, because it's not considered a solid t'nai, a solid stipulation that would make it as if that get wasn't ever a get. So therefore, there's no reason to have this takana to make it absolutely final when he divorces her, and if he decides to remarry her, kohen chachamim, he can do so. Let's continue. Niset l'acher, if she indeed marries someone, v'ayu lo banim hamena, and she has children, and now she comes back to her first husband, V'itovat k'tubata, and she says, I like my k'tuba. And if you recall back in Masechta K'tuba, we said that an eilunit that is divorced, she doesn't receive the sum of money in the k'tuba. And that is assuming that the husband didn't know she was an eilunit in the time of marriage. So therefore, she's saying, well, look, you divorced me, didn't give me my k'tuba, but now I've had children, so I'm due a k'tuba. So Rabbi Yehuda says, Omrim la, we say to her, Shtikutich yafelich midiburich. Your silence in this context is better than your speech. In other words, if you start now raising your voice and saying, I'd like my ketubah back, it might prompt the husband to start saying, well, had I known that I'd have to pay your ketubah, I would have never have divorced you. And that would end up being more detrimental to her because it would undermine her current marriage. So that's why Rabbi Yehuda says, Shtikutech, sometimes it's better to be quiet than try and raise your voice. Let's continue. This is now Mishnah Tet. Hamocher tatzmo vet banav l'goy. If someone sells himself and his son to goyim, in other words, sells himself to be avanim, to be servants, then ein podin oto, then we don't redeem him. And that is because we don't want to encourage him to keep doing that. In other words, he's generating money by selling himself, and he's going to rely on the fact that Beit Din are going to try and rescue me and redeem me. So this could be a good way of raising money. Gemara actually explains this is not really the first time it occurs. This is only if he's considered, if you like, a repeat offender, that he sold himself and his son one or two times. And when it comes to the third time this happens, in other words, after the first and second time Beit Din have redeemed him, then from that point on, we realize this person's trying to make a business out of it, so they don't redeem him again. However, aval poninet banim lachar mitat avihem, if the father passes away while he's still under the care of the goyim, then we do redeem the sons, in other words, so they don't get lost amongst the goyim. Now, hamocher et sadehu legoy v'chazal lokcha memenu Yisrael. Someone sells his field in Eretz Israel to a goy, and then an Israel, meaning a Jew, purchases it from him. He who purchases it, despite the fact the fruit grew in the property of the goy, would have to bring bikurim mipnei tikkun olam. Now there are two versions of this, two different girsot, if you like, this Mishnah. The Batanur actually reads at the end, lokeach umevi mikurim mipnei tikkun olam. In other words, according to Batanura, despite the fact he sold it to a goy, the person who sold it to him would have to continually purchase the bikurim from this goy and bring it to Yerushalayim. So it's hamocher sadeh legoyim, lokeach umivik bikurim. That's mipnei tikkun olam, because we're trying to create a disincentive to sell land within Eretz Yisrael to the goyim. That's the way the Batanura reads it. However, the way I read initially, Kati explains it slightly differently. So in other words, the way we read initially is Hamocher Tadeo Lagoi Vechazar Lakhaim in Israel, and Israel comes and purchases it, then Halokeach, that's next purchaser, would have to bring Bikurim. So what's this mean in Tikkun Olam? That the next purchaser has to bring Bikurim. So the Gemara explains that this seems to be going according to the understanding that if a non-Jew purchases land in Eretz Israel, it's not Mafkim Mikdushata. It doesn't become as if it's not like land in Eretz Israel, and the Kedusha of the land still exists, and therefore, say, the first fruit grown in the land, a Bikurim would apply to it, and the like. So initially what happened is, because the Kedusha wasn't being lost, the attitude of people was like, well, I'm not doing anything terrible by selling it to a non-Jew, because it still has a Kedusha to Eretz Israel. So therefore, the first takana was actually saying, no, halakech min ha-goy, if you purchase from a goy, then you cannot bring Bikurim. And that was to try and put in the conscience of the people that actually, you know, there's zirida mikdushata, there's sort of a drop. So it's not simply you've got new owners, there's something qualitatively different if it's under the possession of a goy. And that way they tried to use that as a disincentive to try and stop people selling land to goyim within Eretz Israel. However, what happened is that under certain circumstances, they realized individuals had to sell land. But what happened is that once it's already in the hands of the goyim, and again, the people's mentality had changed that it's a dropping kedusha, there wasn't any urgency to redeem it. So therefore, Chachamim reverted back to the Din Torah that no, bikurim would apply to the land. Really, it's not mafkia mea kedushata, meaning it still retains kedusha, and that was to try and make people realize, oh, no, this land has the same level of kedusha there as Israel as everywhere else, and therefore, this was to try and create now an incentive to purchase this land back. So it sort of came back in full circle, if you like. So the Mipnei Tikkun Olam wasn't that they instituted a law that wasn't in Torah. It's rather, we've seen this in other contexts as well, actually, that actually they came back to the Din Torah. So in other words, when they purchased this land back from the Goyim and fruit grew on that land, then Bikurim would apply. And that was Din Torah anyway. But it's because of a particular Takana intervening period that was really motivated for good purposes to, again, we said, a disincentive to sell the land. But however, after the Takana, that realized that people actually weren't purchasing land back, but they thought that, it's a low level Kedusha, that they reverted back to the Din Torah to, again, to get people in the mindset that this land, even despite the fact being owned by Goyim, that has the same level of Kedusha, to try and create an incentive to purchase that land back. Those are Mishnah today.